Okay, today I'm in Teddington with somebody that probably doesn't take need much introduction, Nick Luck. Thank you very much for agreeing to talk to us today, Nick.
I'd like to say it's a pleasure, Simon. As you're about to find out, I much prefer sitting where you're sitting.
Excellent, which should make for a good interview then. We'll go straight into it. You won the HWPA Broadcaster of the Year Award, I believe, 7 times, which is voted for by your peers. You're extremely popular with the Channel 4 audience. And then you didn't get, well, I assume you didn't get offered the job with ITV Racing. How tough was that?
I like the way you've gone straight in. I like the way, there's no looseness today. Straight in with a short pitch delivery. Well, we're now nearly 2 years since the end of Channel 4 Racing. It's gone by in a flash. And I'm still here and I'm still working and I'm still having a good time and I'm still enjoying the racing as much as ever. So although it was difficult at the time that period had ended, so that period with Channel 4 had ended, it's amazing how quickly you find a different way of occupying your time and occupying your professional life and finding different ways of fulfilling yourself as well. I'm not saying there weren't moments of worry and concern. There were, because I think you'd only be inhuman if you didn't have concerns that you're going to be able to find the work and sort of find opportunities elsewhere. But things seem to have worked out okay. Just got to keep looking forward, really.
Okay, so we've gone straight into it. So I'll dig a little bit deeper. Channel 4 Racing appeared to be a big, happy family under High Flyer. Was there much tension behind the scenes when the new broom swept through before it finished?
It's quite an interesting observation, that, and I think it's interesting to draw that distinction between what appears to be the case when the viewer's watching and what life is like behind the scenes. And the two things, of course, aren't necessarily the same. And I think probably what I would say is that you don't all necessarily have to get on really well to make really good and vibrant and exciting TV. I would say there were more. It was a happy family under High Flyer, no doubt. And I worked for High Flyer for 8 years, but from 2004. To 2012, but there were probably sort of bigger personalities within that who might have just sort of rubbed up against each other in a slightly awkward way. But on screen, the chemistry came over quite well. The time at IMG from 2012 to the end of 2016, I think it was about as harmonious as you could get between any group of people within it. I mean, there was certainly no real tensions between any of the members of the team. Maybe we were all too nice to each other. Maybe you go back in time, it would have been better if we hadn't got on so well. But we did all get on extremely well. There's sort of me and Rishi Prasad, Emma Spencer, Gina Harding, Graham Cunningham, Jim McGrath, Simon Holt, Tanya. I mean, there weren't any sort of difficult personalities in there, and everyone got on incredibly well. But what goes on behind the scenes and what appears on screen are not necessarily the same thing.
Okay, one of the personalities that Carl Hicks did sort of jettison was John McCrick, who was your went to school at the same school as you, which
he
was
did.
Harrow.
He did,
as well as several other racing boys. Having, I imagine, a very privileged education there, was there like a future mapped out for you by your sort of parents, etc.?
Well, given the amount of money people spend on education, if they send people to schools like the one I went to and the one that a lot of people who work in racing TV went to, I suppose there should be a career mapped out, but there definitely wasn't a career mapped out. You can say it was a waste of money if you like. Listen, I think if you spoke to anyone who knew me when I was 16, 17 and said, oh yeah, Nick will be doing racing on the telly, I don't think they'd be that surprised, because I always had the racing poster in my room at school and I was always obsessed with racing, and you weren't really allowed to watch much TV, and I managed to smuggle in a telly that had about a 1.5-inch screen, which would be even smaller than watching your average iPhone now, and would watch Channel 4 Racing on it, or BBC Racing, whatever, every Saturday and every midweek and every time I could remember. And if I couldn't use that, then I'd listen to it on 5 Live, which, or Radio 5 as it was then, which played quite a lot of racing at the time. So I don't think anyone would have been that surprised that I'd ended up in racing, and probably nor that surprised that I'd ended up in the TV side of it, Simon, because, I I always liked speaking and performing and acting and all that sort of thing. So the two things came together quite nicely. That said, there wasn't really much strategy behind it at all. I just ended up being quite lucky.
It was interesting you mentioned the acting, because I did dig up when I was doing my Google researching on you that you were very interested in drama in your youth.
I was,
so,
yeah.
So was there ever an ambition to actually do that professionally?
Well, funnily enough, the nearest I ever came to thinking I wanted to do it professionally was around about the time I started doing this sort of thing, which was at the sort of end of around about 2002, I'd say, because I was in the middle of doing a sketch show in London or on the Fringe, and I mean, we obviously thought it was incredibly good and avant-garde, and we were going to get signed up by BBC and be the next Far Show or something. In fact, it was probably not all that good, and we probably weren't very good at all. But yeah, there was probably about a 6-month period towards the end of my student career, which I managed to spin out as long as I could because I was having so much fun. Managed to spin my university life out for like a full 5 years, which I thought was a pretty good effort. 3 years in London, then a year in... No, 2 years in London, then a year in Paris, and another 2 years in London. So I had a pretty charmed existence as a student. And I think at the end of that, and I'd done so much of it, that I thought, oh yeah, this would be great, and I could just carry on this nice life. But this came along, and then I realised this was maybe a more sensible option, and it was quite rewarding as well, and it still didn't really feel like that much of a job. So it was just like a seamless continuation in my own crazy head.
So you mastered in French at King's College and did a degree in French. So why French if you were interested in horse racing and you wanted to be a...
Well, you can't really do a degree in horse racing. Well, I suppose you can now, probably, but you I don't think you could... When I was applying 20 years ago, I don't think you could do a degree in racing, otherwise I might have been quite interested. No, I think that, you know, culturally there was this expectation that you would go to what was considered to be a reasonable university and do a degree that was, you know, if you were a scientist, you'd do something, you know, a good science degree or a medical degree, and if you were more arty, you'd do what some would consider a pointless, but I would consider very fulfilling humanities degree. So yeah, no, I ended up doing French. I'd started doing French and English, and I didn't enjoy the English department there terribly. So I just did single honours, and then I'd like to say I got really enthused by French literature in my final year. And that is partly true, but it is also significantly true that I was having a very good time and was enjoying my relatively free and quite easy life in London at the time, and so I really wanted to stay and study more and do more. So I applied for a master's and did an MA in French literature, which actually was pretty academically rewarding because it was quite hard. I remember going into the first seminar I did and thought, I might have bitten off more than I can chew here, because they'd all come down from Oxbridge and were all significantly smarter than me. So yeah, then I actually had to pull my finger out and do some work, which was probably good for me, because I needed it at the time.
So then the real work kicked in. What was your big break with the racing broadcasting?
Well, it's a long and quite boring story, but you've got all day, so I'll tell it you. I sort of took around that period, I met a guy who had no connection with horse racing called Brian Rogers, who was an Australian guy, a friend of a friend of mine. And he had, I think he left his job in the finance department of the Financial Times. And I was having a drink with him one day, and I said, well, what are you doing now? And he said, oh, I've moved to a horse racing channel as a accountant or a finance man. And I said, oh, what's that? He said, oh, at the races. I said, well, I've been watching that, and it had just started. It had been going about 4 or 5 months. And he said, oh, you'd be great on there. Because he knew I was into racing, and he knew I was interested in it and whatever. And so I'd sort of laughed and thought no more about it. So about 2 weeks later, I bumped into him again. He said, oh, I've been down to the studios in Hayes. They were then, the Sky Business Studios in Hayes. And he said, oh, they're desperate for people to work on their American racing program. And he knew that I'd spent a year... After I left school, I went to Kentucky for a year and worked there for a company called Kentucky Equine Research. And I essentially was just writing there, going racing a bit, but writing a lot about mainly about equine science, to be honest with you, but getting quite a bit of experience in the racing scene. So he knew I knew a little bit about American racing, quite a lot about racing. And I said, well, I'm not sure I know enough to do anything on TV. And he said, look, their options are not that plentiful. They really need to get this off the ground, and they've got to do 7 nights a week, and they've got to do however many hours a week. So he gave me the number of a man who was to become a pretty significant influence in my professional life, really, and has been to a lot of people, Jim Ramsey. I don't know if you know Jim. No. But he was started off at World of Sport in the 80s, worked a lot for Channel 4 Racing, had freelance for the BBC and for Sunset and Vine as well. And then he was the channel editor of the original At the Races, which was the joint venture between Sky and Arena and Channel 4 at the time, at the end of 2002. So he's a great man, Jim, and still very much in touch with him, as are a lot of people who sort of worked under him in those days. And he put me in touch with the producer of that branch of it, and they said, oh, we're doing a dummy run tonight. Do you want to go on and do the dummy run? Well, I'd never done any telly in my life. I'd never been on TV. And I said, yeah, all right. Well, I couldn't really say no, could I? So they handed me the cards and said, there you go, off you go, 2 hours dummy run. So I did that with Angus McNay. And I thought, well, I don't really know how that went. And so he rang me up the next day and said, can you do Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday next week? I said, really? He said, yeah. So I said to my wife, I said, girlfriend at the time, now wife, I said, well, that's all right. I said, oh, this is quite good fun. I said, and three of these a week. I said, I'll just keep chipping away, and, you know, eventually I'll get a job, obviously, but, you know, this'll do for the, anyway, 18 years later, I'd never managed to get around to getting a job, but, or 16 years later, I never managed to get around to getting a job. But anyway, here we are, Simon, so.
So is that, you're lucky to consider it something you really enjoy doing rather than a job, what you do now?
No, you have to take it seriously. I mean, I think when you have more responsibilities and you have your family and everything, you have to take it seriously as a career. But it probably took me a while to really do that. But yes, it is a lot of fun. But I've stopped feeling guilty about it now.
Okay, Nick, thanks for that first part there, a little bit of the background. A lot of people would probably know you for Channel 4 Racing originally, where you became a household name as far as racing people go. Can you tell us a little bit about that time? Any special sort of memories or observations of it?
Yeah, it was almost all a good time. And I think because there was a change in the production company sort of two-thirds of the way through the time that I was working there, and because my role became bigger or more significant with them, with the second production company, it's almost easy for me to forget, and for people to forget, that I was there for 8 years before that. So I'd started in, I think I started in 2004. The first show I did for Channel 4 was at Red Car with Graham Good, which was a light end, and lovely man, really looked after me, Gigi. And Stephen Byrne, who then ended up moving to America and working over there, was the producer that day. He was only at Channel 4 for about another year after that. But no, I was used then sort of sporadically by Andrew Franklin, who was the boss of High Flyer, and then a bit more regularly, and sort of became part of the team under him and John Fairley, really. So they were happy days and happy times, but they were difficult times towards the end, because obviously I think everybody knew that change was in the offing, and I think for several years even before there was a change in contract and before the plate shifted, if you like, I think, you know, there was a sense that the network wanted something different, or if the network didn't want something different, then horse racing wanted something different, so the balls were all going to get thrown in the air.
So fast forward to Luck on Sunday,
yeah,
which I think it's fair to say has been a big hit in the racing world. What was the brainchild behind it? Did you suddenly have a eureka moment, or was it put upon you?
I think it's something that Racing UK had always been keen to try out, to do a Sunday morning magazine of some description, but it had been on the back burner an awfully long time, and I don't think anyone really thought that it was going to happen. And then when my commitments changed and I became freer because of the end of the Channel 4 deal, Richard Fitzgerald was keen to sort of breathe some new life into this project. So We talked about it a bit and we didn't really get anywhere and talked about it a bit more. And I went to Hong Kong at the invitation of Pat Cummings in April 2017. And they were talking about showing the Hong Kong racing on a Sunday morning. So I sort of thought, well, maybe we could tie the two things in together and do something. So I spoke to a few of the people there, and then I came back and spoke to a few of the people at the Racing UK, and Bill Esdale was incredibly helpful putting the two parties together. And then there was a pause, as there often is with these things. And no one said a thing. And then it was suddenly, right, yes, we can do it. We'll do it this week. So it was a bit of a, it was a bit of a rush to get it up and running sort of just over a year ago. But it worked out really well. I'd be eternally grateful to Hong Kong for their support of that first series. And sadly, they're no longer with us, but it was great to sort of build it around that to begin with, and it gave us that structure to move forward with. So it's been really good fun. And you know, one of the most enjoyable parts of say doing the morning line for all those years at Channel 4, particularly latterly, was the ability to talk to get like racing professionals and get a tune out of them and try and tease something in a live environment that you might not get out of them otherwise, and to be able to sort of extend that in a kind of longer format has been a lot of fun and a real pleasure.
So what's happened with the Hong Kong connection then?
Well, Hong Kong signed a deal with the new Sky Racing, or At The Races, to do the racing exclusively on that side. So obviously that's meant that Luck on Sunday can't have the Hong Kong racing within it, which is, you know, it's a shame, but I could see that was the way things were shifting, and I think that ATR or Sky are sort of going out to try and show as much international racing as they can. And obviously Racing UK under its new name and new guys next year is going to be loaded with all the best British and Irish racing. So it wasn't that much of a surprise to me that Hong Kong went that way. And, you know, as I say, I'm just very grateful that they stepped in to support our first series. And luckily we've got a great sponsor now in Mali Albasti, who's sponsoring racing all around the world. He sponsors a lot of TV in all countries as well, Dubai and America and here. So yeah, I've known Mali for probably 20 years, and it's great to have his support.
Right, so it's 2.5 hours of live TV.
Well, 2.5 hours if we stick to time.
Right.
I must be the only person who's got that luxury, which I probably shouldn't be afforded, of the fact that if we're bleeding over, then we suddenly get an extra quarter of an hour, which is a pain if you've recorded it on your EPG because it stops at 11:30. But but 2.5 hours.
You've seen me here with my little bits of A4 I keep glancing down at. You've got 2.5 hours of interviews.
I wish I had some A4 to look down at now.
Now, do you have a team to sort of help you research it? Do you get rehearsals?
Oh, that sounds very grand.
You don't then?
Not really, no. We've got a small and very dedicated team. It's not like doing network TV. You know, the guys at ITV and us at Channel 4 before, yeah, there is a good support network. Same when I work for NBC in America. It's, you know, you're obviously going to have a much bigger team because you've got a bigger budget and what have you. But the show does punch above its weight. It's got its own dedicated producer, Bruce Clements, who's really dedicated to it in every sense. And he's a brilliant guest booker. And we chat from Tuesday onwards. You know, I leave him alone on a Monday. Apart from, you know, yesterday when he rings me up and tells me that our main guest has dropped out this week. But I try and leave him alone for a couple of days. And then Tuesday onwards, we just kind of talk about it and gently work our way towards the show. And of course you can't do too much because you want to be able to react to what's happened the previous day as well. And this week we've got, I know this is going to go out probably after Champions Day, but this week, as you're conducting this interview, we've got Champions Day at the end of this week, so obviously that's going to form the basis of this weekend's programme. So you can't do too much planning. And as for notes, well, I don't know. I think it's a temperament thing, really. I just think some people enjoy working without, and some people prefer working with. And I don't think there's a right or wrong way of doing it. I've never been a very noteful person. Well, which probably means I'm lazy, but
which makes it even more amazing. You have appear to have an extremely extensive knowledge of a wide aspect of horse racing. So from breeding to betting to form. I mean, do you have to work on becoming that knowledgeable? Do you just retain knowledge because you're interested?
Well, it's kind of you to say. I suppose you just, I think if you are interested in something, your memory will help you out. And if you, I'm lucky, I have quite a naturally retentive memory. And since I was 23 or 4 whenever I started, anyone who's a little bit older than me in this job keeps saying to me, your memory will go, you know, your memory will go. You will start struggling with that. Now I've got to 40, just, and it's okay. So I'm hopeful, you know?
Yeah.
You're doing all right.
I'm nodding away there.
You're doing all right.
So are you in...
You've got a few years on me.
Yeah, thanks, Nick. Are you in control of the content and the guests, or are they, is, you know, are they sort of chosen for you as a bit of each?
But both, really. I don't think we do... I don't think... I mean, I wouldn't go and book a guest and then... it has to be a collaborative process.
Yeah. And is there a time delay in case of an outburst?
No.
Have you not had an outburst?
No, yeah, you? No. McEasterby has been on the telephone.
So, who's
I was a shame, really, because I got him on to promote his Point to Point, and the producer hadn't even got back down to the gallery, and the F-bomb had been dropped. So it's annoying, really, because I'd quite like to have him on as a guest, but I think he might have stymied that now, which may have been by design.
So who's been your most memorable, favourite stroke interviewee so far?
That's a good question. The ones that stick out from the first series, Cricket Head, just because I think it was just fantastic to get her in the week that she retired, and she came over on the Eurostar specially to do the show, and she was just brilliant and warm and humorous and knowledgeable, and I just thoroughly enjoyed her company. And there was a lovely section between her and Olivier Deleuze, who was riding in Hong Kong, and Graham Cunningham had Olivier Deleuze in Hong Kong, and we had Cricket in the studio, and he'd been a great protege of hers, and he produced this sort of bunch of flowers from behind his back in Hong Kong, and several thousand miles away there was she with a sort of tear in her eye. It was a really sweet moment, and I thought she spoke brilliantly about what it is to train racehorses, what it is to promote the sport, how you need to be more open with the press and the public, which is not an attitude that's been perpetuated, particularly in France, all that much. And she's an absolute pioneer for women in racing, a pioneer for taking racing to the public, a pioneer for being open with the press. And I just thought all of that was embodied in the one interview. And she's delightful and charming. So loved that. I thought Harvey Smith was great. Great character. I think people confuse him with being a sort of gruff, stereotypical Yorkshireman. And he's so much more than that. There's real depth and richness to his character. And he is an absolute legend. And he was one of the most famous people in the country in the 70s and 80s.
And that was a really special interview, wasn't it? I'm watching that myself.
I owe Vanessa Ryle, who works for At The Races, an assist. Her bosses will probably be livid with her, because it was Vanessa who sent me a message saying, ask him about training the Lion Cub. So I owe her one.
And that's one of the most memorable pieces, isn't it, for anybody?
So, you know, just get everyone thinks that people in the racing media are sort of very polar, and whoever you work for, no one kind of cooperates, but it's not the case.
Has there been anybody that's been frustratingly elusive, stroke reclusive, and you want them but they're just not having it?
He won't mind me saying it, but I mean, although John Gosden was our penultimate guest on the first series, and it did take me a little while to wear him down. See, John is obviously, he's very forthcoming on the race course, and he is very, you know, he's got a reputation for being very good with the media and giving lots of interviews, but I'm not sure how much he fancied the idea of coming down to Ealing on a Sunday morning and sitting and having me try and bowl a few googlies at him. But his wife Rachel had been the guest on the third show, so we were at a function in London, and we were coming down in the lift after it had finished. And Rachel said, are you all right? I said, yeah. I said, I'm struggling. I said, I've asked John 12 times to come on the show, and he won't. She said, leave it to me. So we formed a pincer movement and gave him no choice. But he was, when he did come on, he was predictably absolutely brilliant. And the stories he told about his time in America, I think, were exactly what everyone wanted.
And Nick, do you feel, I get the impression that gambling is sort of becoming a dirty topic, even though horse racing is largely funded and revolves around it. Do you get that impression that it is?
It's a very good question. I think 2 or 3 years ago, I was interviewed on the radio about this, and I said I worried that in this neo-puritanical age, which we now appear to be entering into, that gambling was just going to get a bad rap from now on in, and therefore it behoved all the gambling companies to behave in a way that meant that they were beyond reproach, because government now, government potentially of a different colour, was going to start squeezing and squeezing and squeezing, because there was an appetite to remove gambling as a leisure pastime, but to significantly clamp down on it and to regulate it harder, because people were understandably concerned about the possible socially detrimental effects of it. So it was necessary for the gambling companies to behave beyond reproach, and it was also necessary for horse racing as an industry to support the betting industry and form partnerships with the betting industry to make sure betting wasn't seen in that way. Not to step back from it and say, there's your betting, we're the racing, we can just go and promote without betting. The minute you say racing can exist without betting, you're going down an extremely dangerous road, in my opinion. So
yeah,
the short answer to your question is, it is a concern.
Do you think that racing has, or racing broadcasting, not necessarily you, has a, really should be sort of showing that having a Saturday Yankee isn't a dirty thing, and that the people that generally tune in to, you may disagree, but tune into early morning racing programs or whatever, are predominantly interested in gambling. There's probably people that love horses and just want to, but to shy away from the fact that most people want to be tipped a winner or, you know.
I've never understood really why the two things have to be mutually exclusive. I want to make television that's as engaging and interesting and stimulating as possible. You want to see new technologies, you want to see innovation, you want it to be as sparky and as fun as possible. But I don't see why you can't do that and acknowledge the fact that this is a sport that is built on somebody having a bet.
Yeah, because you've had...
literally built on somebody having a bet.
Exactly. You've had Neil Channing on there, obviously, so you've not shied away from professional punters, etc. Do you sort of do research on the sort of guests that you have that gain the most sort of interest, like on social media, that sort of thing? Does that bear into what you...
What, on Luck on Sunday?
Yeah. Does that bear into how you choose your next lot?
No, I don't think it does, really. I realise now that social media drives mainstream media policy, or it drives television executives' policy to a certain extent. You know, they will sort of do that, figure out which way the wind's blowing, and then load up their show, whatever it is, whether it's sport or light entertainment or whatever, with something they perceive will go down well in the echo chamber of Twitter or wherever. But no, I think the luxury of the Sunday programme is that we've sort of been able to do what we want and have who we want on, just because we think they will actually be interesting to people, and the more novel they are, the better. If they then get a great reaction on social media, then brilliant, we'll have them on again.
So you've got a good insight into how things work other places. You work in over in America with NBC. Now, how does horse racing in America compare to the UK, as in the public sort of perception of it and knowledge of it, and, you know, just a sort of awareness of it?
It's significantly behind the UK in that regard, insofar as it's less close to the zeitgeist, if you like, than it is here. the country's huge, the jurisdictions are thousands of miles apart, the competition for the sporting market has not eclipsed it completely, but has rendered it significantly less popular than it was in the glory days of the 60s and 70s in America, when it was really a huge sport and hundreds of thousands of people would attend all the time. Maybe some of the points that you've touched on, maybe the attitude towards gambling, maybe the perception of gamblers has changed. Will the deregulation of sports betting, or the partial deregulation of sports betting and the enabling of sports books, turn that round in racing's favour? Or will being able to bet on other sports in more states than just Nevada actually encroach on racing's territory? I sincerely hope it's the former. From a TV point of view, the landscape's looking a bit rosier, I think, in America, partly because John Miller at NBC and the production team there, Rob Hyland and his team, are pretty passionate about horse racing and have committed to events that, you know, other American networks haven't even considered. And Royal Ascot obviously is one massive example of that. And there could be more British racing being beamed into American households next year. I mean, to have the final morning of Royal Ascot beamed into every American household on the major NBC network, straight off the back of the main network breakfast program, is an unusual but pretty big deal.
It's quite surprising that that's not already happened, really, isn't it? Because Americans appear to be sort of quite big fans of quaint little England in our funny ways.
Yeah, I know, but on the face of it, it's a hard sell to a commissioner, isn't it? Can you take a minor sport, niche sport like racing, and can you take an event, not even just from here, but by the way, from overseas, and can you stick it on your major network when you've got X many auxiliary networks? Can you stick it on your major network? Oh, and by the way, can you put it on for 4 hours? You know, and I know it's 9 till 1 on a Saturday morning, and there might not be that much competition for airtime at that point, but 4 hours on a major network of somebody else's sport in another country is a pretty unusual but very great thing if you happen to be standing in my shoes anyway.
So are your shoes going to be NBC or RUK? RUK's not there, is it?
What's that?
Royal Ascot.
I'll have a shoe of each, but no, RUK won't be there next year anyway, so that makes that one fairly straightforward. But no, I mean, Racing UK have been very good to me in terms of allowing me to take other work where I need to, and it's all dovetailed in quite nicely.
So how does your working environment differ in the US working for racing as opposed to the UK? Would you ever be tempted to relocate?
Oh, I've thought about it umpteen times. You know, part of me thinks that it's something maybe I ought to do one day, and it's an itch I need to scratch, but by the same token, I haven't got forever to think about it. I don't know is the honest question, but yes, I have thought about it. And obviously I thought about it quite a bit when the Channel 4 contract was coming to an end. But events, Simon, take over, don't they? So, you know, before you know it, another year's gone by and you've done another job here and another job there and you've had another child along the way or whatever. So, you know, it just, for whatever reason, it hasn't happened. But I do enjoy the time I spend there a lot. I've got a lot of good friends and I've been extremely well looked after. So, no, it's been a lot of fun. How does the working environment differ? I think program preparation there is a little more precise and a little more intense than it is here. Just comparing network TV here and network TV there.
You mentioned events, which leads me nicely on to you're the BBC equestrian commentator.
Mm.
Now, that's included Babington Horse Trials, Burley Horse Trials, Olympia Horse Show. Was this a side of the horse business that you've always been interested in, or did it take you out of your comfort zone?
A bit of both, I suppose. Insofar as, I mean, I grew up riding badly. I mean, I was really not very good. I had very limited talent, but I did ride nearly every day when I was at home anyway, in the school holidays from when I was, you know, tiny until I was about 20. So I had a bit of knowledge of eventing and show jumping, and I'd grown up in that sort of environment, really, as much as a racing environment. Probably more that environment. So It wasn't alien to me by any stretch of the imagination. That said, I'd be lying if I said I'd followed much equestrianism in the 20 years between times. So I had to learn a bit and learn quite fast. But no, the concepts weren't alien to me, but the context was perhaps.
Okay, now you're a family man, so you've got three children.
Yeah.
You do these sort of overseas jobs, lengthy sort of stints away. How difficult for you is it emotionally to take lengthy overseas jobs, bearing in mind you've got a family, etc.?
Well, I suppose it helps that I've been married for 11 years and I've lived with my wife for 17 years. So she's been quite used to the itinerant lifestyle that I had anyway. So it's not as though it was a massive culture shock, and there's always been periods away. And you know, even if you're doing a week at York, for example, I mean, it's no different essentially to a week in the US. But the trips have got a bit longer and a bit more regular. And so I've been doing quite a bit in the Middle East between December and the end of March as well. So yeah, there's been a lot going on. And it all depends on what's going on at home as well. Obviously, it's been more difficult this year because we've had another baby. You need a fair amount of understanding, which luckily I have from Laura. So it works. It's not always easy. It's not always easy. And certainly if you're away, so if I'm away and there's a bit of downtime, I sort of think, come on, I need to be doing something now, because you know I shouldn't really be here and not doing something meaningful.
Yeah, you mentioned online that your youngest has been diagnosed with cystic fibrosis, mm-hmm. and you wanted to sort of raise awareness. Is that something that you think you'll be getting more involved in, because now you've got a personal attachment with it? Is it?
I hope so. I mean, I'd like to do what I can. I've been wary of sort of diving headfirst into the charitable side of it, because I think we need a bit of time and space to sort of get our heads around exactly what we need to do for Xanthi and to you know, understand her needs and to, you know, incorporate them into what the other girls need and want. So you know, I realise that, you know, we need a little bit of time just to get accustomed to the situation and so forth. But no, I've already been in touch with the CF Trust, who do a brilliant job, and written to my MP Vince Cable, who's raised matters in Parliament, which is good. Matt Hancock's now the Health Secretary, which should be good if I manage to collar him on a race course somewhere. It's amazing how quickly you become engaged in some of the issues pertaining to it when you've got a child who's compromised by it. It's obviously been a big change in our lives this year. But whilst I don't want to be gung-ho about it, because I understand the severity of it, you've also got to make sure, and all our brilliant clinicians at the Royal Brompton Hospital, where we're going with her, tell us this: you've got to be conscious of the fact you want to make life as normal as possible for her, and most importantly as well, as normal as possible for your other children. So we do what we've got to do. We try and give her the best treatment we can, and enjoy life as much as we can at the same time to create the best environment.
Okay, Nick, during your time at Channel 4,
yes,
your profile became a lot higher and you sort of started appearing on mainstream TV. You seem extremely extremely comfortable on shows like Alan Carr, etc. Now, do your aspirations in TV presenting lie beyond racing in the mainstream?
Well, that's a good question. I did enjoy doing those couple of shows, just because it was a completely bizarre, unusual and alien experience. And the shameless lovey in me probably came out as well. So if you'd asked me that question 10, 15 years ago, I'd have probably said yes. Now it's a bit different, because I think you recalibrate your expectations. I think when you're in your late 20s and 30, you think, well, I am destined to take over the world and do everything. And then the realization gradually seeps in that, you know, you need to consolidate what you've got and try and make the most of it. And if other opportunities come along, then so be it. Yes, I will work hard to find opportunities, but I'm not going to chase dreams that seem impossible.
No, you can't leave us hanging like that, Nick. What was so bizarre about being on the Alan Carr Show?
Just one, that I was in a world of celebrity that I didn't really think I ought to be inhabiting. I pulled up, the first one I did, I pulled up in the car outside the London studios, and there's, you know, 500 screaming 15-year-old girls. And as my door opens, they all start screaming, "Nick, Nick, Nick," and I'm thinking, this is just an extraordinary parallel universe I've entered into. And as I got out of the car and turned round, you could hear a pin drop. Autograph books all went down, and one turned to the other and said, "It's not Nick Jonas, is it?" So, you know, I was out of my comfort zone in a big way, but it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun.
So, I mean, how does it? Is there really that behind the scenes sort of fawning and stuff with the star, you know, with the sort of the stars in that sort of greater TV?
I haven't seen enough of that environment to know of it, to be honest with you. I mean, the only thing in racing is that you do get to meet some quite interesting and famous people, because their sort of lives kind of tend to brush the lives of the rich and famous, who often are involved in racing in some capacity. So you do get to meet some quite unusual and interesting characters in the sport, I think.
You've left that you sort of leave the door open to that you would aspire to if the opportunity arose.
What,
to be...
Do I want to diversify a bit more, do you mean?
Well, I mean, you've sort of said there that if the opportunity, I've understood it, if the opportunity arose, you would quite like to be, if you did a, you could do a chat show that's not focused on racing at all.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing if I could transfer whatever abilities and skills I may have to something a bit wider than just the scope of horse racing. But if a path was created for me to be able to do that, then that would be fantastic.
Do you think that maybe now is the time to push for it before you become the sort of face of racing, and that is how people always will look at you?
Yeah, the trouble is, Simon, I think people were saying that to me 10 and 15 years ago, so maybe I should have been pushing for it then. I don't think the ship has sailed necessarily. I never do, because I just think I think that this is a sort of industry where anything can happen at any time. And in all forms of TV and in all media, the plates are shifting so much more regularly. So much more regularly. I mean, just look at racing. I mean, you've mentioned the transitions between production companies at Channel 4 and then Channel 4 to ITV, and now they're talking about, well, will Sky take over the world, etc., etc. That's not just racing. That's a microcosm of all of not, it's not just a microcosm of sports rights. It's a microcosm of television in general. So you can never say never.
Okay, right, we're going to go straight back into racing now. Mm-hmm. For all those people who are watching. Are you a punter?
I bet. Punter kind of implies that A, I do it well, and B, that I do it with the sort of regularity and intensity that is expected and demanded. But yeah, I bet.
So would you actively get the form book out and see if you could find a winner for tomorrow in order to back it?
No, I think my betting is opportunistic rather than regular. I think I could probably date this actually pretty well. I'd say until 2011 or 12, I was betting daily, or if not daily, extremely regularly. And, you know, I was never making any significant money, but I wasn't losing any. And I was betting in significantly larger amounts than I would now. I do think things change a bit when you have children, or at least they did in my case. So now I bet, but I wouldn't call myself a massive punter.
So would you get your somebody give you a phone call and say you might want to have a fiver on this one? Is that how it would work?
Yeah, I'd back it, yeah. Obviously. I haven't completely lost it. But also, if you're tipping as well, and I've tipped occasionally for a number of different people over the years, whether they be newspapers or betting companies or whatever. You need to still be betting. I genuinely believe you can't really apply yourself to that unless you are having a bet on at least a semi-regular basis.
So has the role of a tipster become a bit fraught these days with everybody, as we talked about earlier, you know, gambling's bad, you've told people that when it's lost, they've lost their money. You're encouraging vulnerable people to bet money they can't afford, blah, blah, blah. You know, is that sort of creeping into it, you think, now? Is there a bigger responsibility if you're putting one up on TV or somewhere?
I think you always have to take it seriously if you're doing it. I mean, I've had a couple of absolutely shocking weeks of late, and it does bother you. But like everything, you can't let it bother you too much, otherwise you can't go and apply yourself to it the next week. And I think people realise that it's not necessarily my main discipline, but it is also something I enjoy and hopefully provide a bit of entertainment along the way. And as you say, racing is supposed to be an enjoyable pastime, and betting's supposed to be an enjoyable pastime. We get very heavy about it quite a lot, and most people don't apply themselves to it in a particularly heavy duty fashion. They apply themselves to it in a fashion that's entirely healthy and entirely in keeping with a leisure activity.
Right. So, talking about leisure activities, I've read in my Googling again that you
you've definitely not read that I've got any sporting prowess, that's for sure.
You've had interests in horses in training, do you?
Yes,
currently?
Yes, quite a few along the... I've always thought I've had a couple of horses, or I had a couple of interests in horses down the years, and then I actually counted how many I'd had bits in and gave myself a bit of a fright. I mean, I'm not into the Dixon Brothers League or anything like that, but yes, I have one. I have a leg of one filly at the moment who won a couple of races last year. She's called Acadian Angel. She's in training with John Quinn. I own her with John and his son Sean, and his stepdaughter Kelly and her husband Rob. And we've had some fun with her last year. She won a couple of races. I think we thought she was going to be better than she's transpired to be, but I think she's got the ability. But like quite a lot of horses, is inclined only to produce just enough. And at the moment, it's not really enough either. She went to air the other day and came there to win and didn't. And I'm still trying to work out how or why. I think she might even have a time form squiggle now.
Oh dear.
But still, if she can turn up and get placed every time, I'm happy enough. But yeah, she looked like she was going to be decent and hasn't quite worked out. But I suppose the old stayer that I bored everyone with for years, Hawk Mountain, he was probably the best one I had an interest in.
Has there been any family history of owning horses going back generations?
Not generations and generations, but yeah. I mean, really, my family's interest in racing started not generations ago, but in the 70s, I guess. I mean, my mum is very, very horsey and was a pretty accomplished horsewoman. She evented and show jumped and was always interested in the racing. And it was actually through, you were talking about equestrianism earlier, it was through, I think, an equestrian connection, or my mum being at a certain show or event or something like that, that my dad was at the bar and was chatting to Josh Gifford. And that was in the early 70s. And I think Josh had just retired from riding and he was still a young guy, so just in his early 30s. And he persuaded my dad that it would be a good idea if he could have a horse in training with him, which I'm pretty sure my dad couldn't have afforded on his own. So he went to his father, who was mildly interested, but not that interested. And I think between the two of them, they were persuaded they'd go down and have a horse in training. So they all went down and picked one. And my mum picked one out and they bought this jumper and it failed the vet. And so Josh sold it to somebody else and it won the Hennessy. And I think ran okay in a Gold Cup, a horse called Approaching. So some friends of ours, very cruelly, when I was growing up, if we ever went round to lunch there, this guy would always put the placemat of Approaching on my dad's place just to rub it in. Well, I've digressed onto completely. I can't even remember where this question started.
I asked if your family had
interest in horses. Yeah, so actually, the horse they bought because Approaching had failed the vet was a small horse called Flying Orchid, who I don't remember because this is before I was, just before I was born, sort of in mid-70s. Did well, won a bunch of races. Like Chris Pitt, I did an interview with him a few years ago, and he dug out every race he'd won. Races like the Terry Wogan Handicap Chase at Chepstow, and he ran in races like the Oxo Brook Bond National and the Whitbread and races like that. So yeah, he was probably the best one they had, to be honest. And they'd only ever have one occasionally at any given time. So they never had a string of horses, and they didn't always have one in training, but more often than not, they'd have one with Josh. In the days when people who owned a horse as a bit of a luxury tended to have one horse. The one horse owner has virtually disappeared. It's either your oligarch or your magnate or a syndicate of a significant number of people, because the way the game has gone and the finances of the game have essentially shunted that one, two horse owner out of it a little bit, especially jumping.
Okay, we talked at the in the last part that sort of things have shifted, the one or two horse owner disappeared, etc. Do you think in the 21st century that racing has still seem too establishment and too elitist to ever become real mass market?
Maybe, though I'm unconvinced of that. I mean, if we've talked about one and two horse owners disappearing, that's simply because the economics of it are so swinging now, I think. It's simply too expensive for the sort of person who's got a little bit of resource to have a horse in training without being, you know. And as I said, I think that applies to the jumping rather than the flat. I mean, we need to separate this out if we're going to talk about whether it's seen as too elitist and too establishment. We came into this conversation talking about ownership. And I think the idea of democratising ownership and trying to broaden it up to more people and trying to facilitate syndicates to do that is clearly a good thing. And to try and follow the model that works really well in Australia. And I'm actually seeing in America now more shared ownerships. You know, more... Even bigger concerns are sharing more. And if the biggest concerns start to share more, then that will trickle down and the smaller concerns will do the same. That should be a good thing for the industry. In terms of whether the sport as a whole is seen as too establishment and elitist, maybe. I think big efforts have been made in the last decade to open the sport up. And if you go to those big race days in the summer, at some of the bigger tracks, you know, it's hard not to notice the efforts that have been made to get people to go racing and to get people from a reasonably broad spectrum of backgrounds to go to the sport. Yes, there aren't enough women in senior positions in the sport, and that's a puzzle to me, because such a significant part of a racing crowd is made up of female racegoers, and all equestrian disciplines, racing included, has as big a following amongst women as it does amongst men. So I think there should be more women leaders in the sport to reflect that. Are there enough people across the social spectrum coming racing? It's a difficult question to answer, and you couldn't definitively say that the answer is no, because I think racing is an attractive day, and I think it is reasonably priced as well. I don't think we're pricing the sport beyond the majority of people. Should the racing crowd look a bit more like look a bit more representative of the country, then yes, it should. Definitely.
There's always been the smaller kings. So, you know, Royal Ascot, the Queen's there, and somebody that it's unemployed can be there.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a chance that, you know, you sort of bump.
So well, this is an interesting point, and this is maybe something I can articulate a bit better than what I was scrabbling around with a few moments ago, in that ratings messaging can be a bit confused. Because on one hand, the messaging is quite aspirational, particularly something like Royal Ascot. It's dress up, top hat, something that's so old school and so quintessentially establishment. And we celebrate that, we venerate that, we make it a feature of the whole piece. And that is one of our biggest racing weeks of the year. And then on the other hand, we're saying, well, we don't want to seem too elitist. We don't want to seem too unapproachable. We don't want to seem too inaccessible. So how do you marry those two things? How do you stay elite level sport, the idea of a high-end social event, the high-end leisure event, promoting this as a luxury brand? You'll hear that said by marketing people within the sport, quite understandably, and I'm not saying it's wrong, you will hear that from marketing people at the big race courses, words like luxury brand, high-end, you know, elite entertainment. But then on the other hand, you'll hear most of us crying out for a broader spectrum of society represented at the races. How do we get people from all sorts of walks of life? How do we get people from all ethnic minorities into the gates of the race courses? Well, it's very difficult to marry up those two concepts, both of which have great merit, but could easily be seen to be in conflict with one another. Mm-hmm. Does that make it? Am I making sense?
Yeah, but one of my bugbears, Royal Ascot, my mum's 75th birthday, I wanted to buy her a ticket for Royal Enclosure. And I had the money, but I was told she wasn't welcome not in so many words, because I didn't know anybody that could vouch or sponsor. Now, has that got any place in the 21st century, do you think?
Well, this is it. This is exactly what I'm talking about, essentially. Is that importance is placed on maintaining the character and the unique nature of an event like Royal Ascot. And I don't want to say this is all about Royal Ascot, because I think this is a thread that runs through a lot of the summer festivals. You know, this is an elite experience. We want to make this exclusive. And yet your story says that people are going to be naturally discomforted by that. And is that a good thing? Well, I'm not so sure it is. So somehow I think those two aspirations, making the sport an elite experience and a high-level, aspirational experience, it shouldn't render it inaccessible somehow. And somehow those two things have got to come together.
I suppose that
the rhetoric can appear contradictory to the outsider, I think. And I'd love to know what some of the sort of significant players within the marketing of the sport think of those two things sitting side by side, of saying, you know, we're selling the Royal Enclosure and the concept of the Royal Enclosure to the world, yet it is fundamentally the most exclusive part of our sport. We are very happy to sell it. And I'm perfectly happy to sell it and defend it. But then on the other hand, we're saying, well, hang on, we can't really sell the sport on inaccessibility. So where are we going with this?
Well, I suppose on the plus side, people that have done quite well that are socially aspirational may see that as a lure to get them involved in racing, thinking they may be able to mix, you know, keep themselves in better company, etc. Do you think that's part of the lure for this sport for some people?
Maybe it is. I suppose habitually, events like that and Glorious Goodwood were part of what used to be known as the summer season, which was for the sort of elite socialites and all that. I think that's kind of, that concept is a bit passé now. But yeah, people still see Ascot as a big society event and something that maybe will give them or cement their entree into a world that they want to exist in.
Now, I've often argued that racing really should be a top PR company's dream, and it's got everything.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Colour, excitement, glamour, you know. But racing, do you think that racing does enough to promote itself, especially rising to the demographic problems? Or does it rely on bookmakers and broadcasters to do their, in inverted commas, dirty work for them and then let them take the flack?
Oh, I think you're only sensible to use your broadcasters. Mm. You've got to use your media if you're promoting the sport.
Does, you ever see adverts from racing itself trying to sell itself?
Well, I was at Waterloo Station the other day and I looked up and there was a billboard about as big as the size of your house promoting Champions Day. And I'd just come back from the States and I thought, my God, if anyone in America saw something like this promoting the Breeders' Cup at the biggest, you know, biggest railway station in the country, they'd be pretty pleased with that. So I don't think that the promoters of British racing do a bad job in getting the exposure out there. It's difficult to know what more they could do, in truth. I think they need to spread their efforts maybe a bit more evenly across all courses at all times of the year. I mean, I understand why Great British Racing and British Champions Series are very closely aligned. And I understand why they focus an awful lot of effort on KIPCO British Champions Day, you know, with the way that that arm of British racing is funded. But I think that, you know, every festival and every jumps festival and flat festival and big meeting needs to be promoted with equal weight, essentially, by the sport's own marketing arm. Obviously, then it's up to the race courses, the individual race courses, to do their thing. But you know, I think there should be a sort of broader approach across the year.
Do you think racing in some ways is too incestuous? So if they took a promotional company, a PR company from totally outside of racing and let them deal with it, there would be different sort of...
Yeah, but you slightly had this when the forerunner to GBR, Racing for Change, was initiated. To significant scepticism, and you have to give credit to those who run Great British Racing for turning the perception of that around. Because when a company was set up to try and promote British racing and to try and promote it to a new generation, a new audience, and to take racing outside the bubble, it had enormous amount of scorn poured on it from within and without. And that, I think, that perception has completely changed. I think the idea now that it is a necessity for racing to be properly marketed and for there to be a concerted effort from the centre is completely understood. So I'd give full marks to Rod Street and everybody else involved with that venture for getting that perception to shift. And as I said, I've already made the point about how I'd like to see the resource spread a bit more evenly through the year and not focus maybe quite so much just on the Champions Series. But that's a side point. I was getting around to making my point, Simon.
That's okay.
Just nudge me. I told you I was better at asking the questions than answering them. Where was I going with this?
We're talking about whether it's an outside...
Oh, an outside agency. Yes, we have been there, and that's what I meant to say. So Racing for Change, when it started off, you'll remember they employed an outside consultancy to launch this. And whilst they were... they had a lot of interesting things to say, some of their kind of understanding of the sport, well, it showed their lack of understanding of the sport. They were way wide of the mark, to be honest. So... yeah, I think we probably got the balance about right. Also, I'm very wary of bringing in management consultants and the like. God, I wish I'd been the person who had the idea to be a management consultant.
Well, I'm going to give you a bit
of power.
Well,
they just talk absolute rubbish and charge you a fortune for it. Talking about low-hanging fruit and deep dives and... This is what they do.
Start new thinking.
The problem with them is they'll come in to a racing organisation, for example, tell you exactly what you know already and what you want to hear, reinforce your prejudices, And then you all sit around going, yeah, I've got to do something about this, got to do something about this. And then they'll pass you an enormous invoice.
Right, I'm going to give you a bit of power now.
Go on.
You're the head of the BHA for this question.
No thanks.
What are you going to turn your attention to first?
Well, if I was the head of the BHA, yeah, I would turn my hand to ensuring that race day, I know this is going to sound very boring and not broad brush enough perhaps, and not visionary enough, but if I was the head of the BHA, as it is right now, I would prioritise, and I think they're trying to do this, but I would prioritise making sure that race days run without any embarrassment, glitch, cock-up, anything that damages the integrity and reputation of the sport and turns punters away from it. The BHA, I think, are well received at the moment as a general rule for a lot of the initiatives they're putting forward in the sport. For a lot of the rhetoric that comes out of Hoban, and a lot of the sort of broad brush aspirations of the organisation, I think the BHA is quite admired. I think they're admired for being progressive, promoting diversity, which they're doing very well, holding stakeholders to account, which they are doing effectively, though perhaps not to everyone's taste. I think they promote debate, and have promoted some interesting debate. I think they've shown a commitment to welfare. I think all those, you know, key political themes have been dealt with extremely well by the current management. But what hasn't, I think some of the more intricate regulatory issues have been found wanting. And that's what they really need to look at, that there aren't the smaller, more low profile, yet just as significant cock-ups taking place on a daily basis on a race course.
Okay, Nick, and finally, is the future bright for racing?
Not bad. Not bad. I think I'm not a pessimistic person by nature. I'm realistic. I'm a little bit worried that there aren't as many fans of the sport as there should be. You know, I think people will have a bet on it still. And I think that people will go racing. But are there enough real fans of the sport for its own sake? And if there aren't, how do we make the sport appealing? And that's the challenge for all of us.
Brilliant. Nick Luck, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure, Simon.
For the latest political betting news and odds, check in with our expert, William Kajani, at starsportsbet.co.uk. BeGambleAware.org. Over 18 only.